It's the Ralph Nader Radio Hour.
Stand up, stand up. You've been sitting way too long.
Welcome to the Ralph Nader Radio Hour. My name is Steve Scrovan, along with my trusty co-host, David Feldman. Hello, David.
The anti-trusty co-host.
Anti-trusty co-host, especially since what happened with JetBlue and Spirit this week. And also the man of the hour, Ralph Nader. Hello, Ralph.
Hello, everybody.
I hope you've gotten over your birthday hangover. Our first guest today is Professor Barbara McQuaid. Some of you may recognize her from the legal commentary she provides NBC News and MSNBC. She also teaches law at the University of Michigan and has written a book which is climbing the charts. It's entitled Attack from Within: How Disinformation is Sabotaging America. In the book, she defines disinformation as, quote, the deliberate use of lies to manipulate people, whether to extract profit or to advance a political agenda. Its unwitting accomplice, misinformation, is spread by unknowing dupes who repeat lies they believe to be true, unquote. Professor McQuaid chronicles how authoritarians use these techniques to disarm their enemies and rise to power, and how, in this historical moment, the Trump MAGA movement is using the same playbook. Then we turn back to the ongoing genocide in Gaza. For that, we welcome back frequent guest, retired Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson. Regular listeners know Colonel Wilkerson as Secretary of State Colin Powell's chief of staff and special assistant to General Powell when he was chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. He's been in the rooms where these types of military and diplomatic decisions have been made and will give us his take on how to interpret what is happening now. And stay tuned, because Colonel Wilkerson is not one to mince words. As always, in between, we will check in with our indefatigable corporate crime reporter, Russell Mokhiber. But first, Ralph has stated many times that empires usually crumble from within. Our first guest has outlined for us the nature of that attack. David?
Barbara McQuaid served as United States Attorney for the Eastern District of Michigan from 2010 to 2017 as part of President Donald Trump's 2017 dismissal of U.S. attorneys. She stepped down in March of 2017. She's a professor of law at the University of Michigan Law School, a legal analyst for NBC News and MSNBC. Her latest book is Attack from Within: How Disinformation is Sabotaging America. It's published by Seven Stories Press. Welcome to the Ralph Nader Radio Hour, Barbara McQuaid.
Well, thanks very much for having me. I'm really glad to be here.
Thank you very much, Barbara. First, I always like to give authors the opportunity to explain their book before we then start the question process, and I'm going to ask you to do that as well. But before I do, I just want to ask you, why did you use the word disinformation? And I ask that for two reasons. One is, this is a relatively recent word. The word used to be propaganda. And in 1970 Merriam-Webster Dictionary, disinformation isn't even listed. And if you asked an ordinary person or persons, what does disinformation mean to you? What would they say?
Disinformation comes from a world that I'm familiar with, which is in national security. As a prosecutor, I worked in counterintelligence. And as a law professor, I teach a course on national security. And so disinformation is information warfare. It is an effort to use information in a way that is designed to mislead, to deceive, and to manipulate. So in some ways, I suppose it's similar to propaganda, but it is a tradecraft. And in my book, what I hope to do is to educate people about this tradecraft, open their eyes to how it works so that they can build resilience against it and prevent the kind of manipulation it is designed to achieve.
This is an overwhelming book, listeners. It's a jackhammer of documentation about what's happening to the very concept of truth in this country, never mind facts. So can you tell us what you tried to do with this book and describe it in your own words?
Yes, thank you for that opportunity. Well, the goal of the book is to sort of describe what I see happening in our country at the moment, to explain how it is harming our democracy, public safety, and the rule of law, and offer some proposed solutions. And so I intend to make it very accessible to the average reader, so that we can try to understand this political moment and get out from under it. My background, as I said, is as a national security prosecutor, so I see this as a threat to our national security. And I think that there are two main drivers of what is happening right now that is causing this onslaught of disinformation. One is technology, which, you know, can be a wonderful tool, the ability to communicate with people around the world about our interests and hobbies and connections is a wonderful thing. But like most technology, like most tools, it can be used as a weapon. And so for those who want to deceive or manipulate people, it has become very easy to take false information and push it online. And what used to take months or years to indoctrinate people can now be done with the push of a button by sending a message that will reach millions of people in just a moment. And so that technology, I think, is really something that is a game changer. I think the other thing that is happening right now is that we are seeing people who are so convinced that their side is right. We are so polarized that they are willing to choose the ends over the means. They care about their vision of America, and therefore they are willing to say whatever it takes to support that vision of America. Some people are deceived by these lies, but many others know the truth and yet push false claims anyway. I think these are people who are choosing tribe over truth. And just to give you an example, there are certainly some people who believe that the 2020 election was stolen. But I think there are plenty of other people in Congress who absolutely know that was not the case and yet will push that claim anyway because they believe it helps them politically. Elise Stefanik, the congresswoman from New York, has begun repeating the phrase Donald Trump uses, which is to refer to defendants who have been convicted and incarcerated for their acts on January 6th as hostages, suggesting that they are political prisoners in some way. She most certainly knows better. Josh Hawley and Ted Cruz, senators who are Ivy League educated lawyers, certainly know how elections are supposed to be counted and certified and know that there was no fraud in the last election. And yet, even after the attack on the Capitol, they voted against certifying the results of that election. So I think that it is that deliberate choice of tribe over truth combined with technology that has put us in a very dangerous place.
Let's dissect this. Do you think, on the whole, that the internet has damaged democracy and truth and factual dialogue more than it's enhanced it?
I don't know. Maybe a little bit of both. You know, we have the ability now, I think, to talk with a lot of other people across differences. I think one of the things that technology and social media has done is it has really changed the way we talk about politics. You know, it used to be said that all politics is local. I think now all politics is national. And I think some of that is because we are talking at a national and even international level with people online about what's happening in our country and our world, instead of talking with our neighbors in person about the garbage pickup and the streetlights. And so I think that that has caused us to disengage from normal civic society and instead, you know, spend our political time reading online, communicating with people online and not in real life. I think there's also been a contributing factor in the demise of local journalism that has made it harder for us to come together as communities and understand what's happening in our communities. And instead, we are left to rely on proxies to tell us what's happening at the national level instead of engaging at the local level. And I think that's to our detriment.
The local journalism point is very crucial in your book because local journalism has a checkmate of local observation for accuracy. And not only does it generate original content, but it also is more accountable because it's more immediate to the readers, and the readers in their knowledge of the community can debunk any false statements. But I'm not asking you about the potential of the internet. I'm saying as of today, March 2024, since the internet came on board with the funding of the Pentagon to develop it, do you think on balance it has damaged democracy and all its disparate characteristics more than it's enhanced it?
Yeah, I don't know if I can reach a calculation. You know, certainly social media is what allowed the Arab Spring individuals to organize and share information. So in some ways, there is some power that is gained by the people with it, but also certainly some harms. You know, one of the things that I teach in my national security class is the conclusions of Robert Mueller in his investigation in the 2016 election and about Russian influence. And, you know, most people focus on the aspects about Donald Trump, but the aspects about Russia in there are really interesting because it describes in great detail how Russian operatives were able to use social media and the internet to deceive American people and influence our elections and sow division in society, which they are still actively doing. And now I think American political operatives have seen how effective it can be and do the same thing. So, for example, some of the things that Robert Mueller cites is accounts that were run by Russian operatives that were set up many, many months before the 2016 election and were designed to develop loyal followers. So they had names like Blacktivist that looked like a Black political activist, or United Muslims of America, or Tennessee GOP, or Heart of Texas, or Coal Miners of America. And all of these looked like they were genuine grassroots Americans, and they said things that most members of those groups would believe in and find non-controversial and that they would support. And so over time, they built large, large followings. And then as they get close to the election, they would say things that were incredibly harmful and damaging, like the Blacktivist account repeated over and over again. Black voters should not go out and vote for Hillary Clinton. She's never done anything for us. She ignores us. And so we should send a strong message that we should not be ignored. You can't ignore our voice and not show up or vote for her on election day.
You're dodging the question. The question is, to date, has the internet been more of a damage to our democracy than it has helped? And my answer is yes. And you know what my basic evidence for that is? It's called the book by Barbara McQuaid called Attack from Within, How Disinformation is Sabotaging America. Now, you're making a point that's very important. People are not willing to come to these conclusions because it's too dispiriting. It's too fatalistic. But it's true. Let me indicate one part in your book, anonymity. Anonymity on the internet is the cause of a huge amount of threats, slanders, fake information, corrosive dialogue, defamation, etc. And so newspaper editors I've talked to, I say, you don't allow anonymity when you print a letter to the editor.
Right.
Why are you allowing anonymity on your website? Well, we want to get more clicks. We want to get more visits. How would you handle anonymity on the internet by regulation?
Yeah, that's a great question. And for the record, my answer to your question about, you know, are we better or worse off is, I don't know. I think we're both. I think we're better off in many ways and we're worse off in others. But it's here to stay. And so I don't think it's a solution to say, let's abolish the internet. I think it's, how can we fix it and make it better? And so when the internet began, it was endless possibilities. And I think we did not foresee all the ways in which it could be abused. And so in 1996, when, you know, social media didn't even exist, it was just in its infancy, we passed Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act, which provided for immunity from legal liability for social media platforms, which probably sounded like a great idea at the time. It probably allowed all of the innovation that we have seen come to roost today. Some of which is great. America is a leader in social media platforms. But I think we've reached a point where we see the problems and the collateral consequences, and we need to make some changes. You know, as I say in the book, Ralph, the internet is like, you know, growing a baby alligator in your bathtub. It was adorable when it started and so exciting. And then it grew into a man-eating predator. So we need to change the way we deal with it. And so with regard to anonymity, I think it would be beneficial to prohibit anonymity online for just the reasons you say. People behave horribly when they can be anonymous. People are just mean when they can behave anonymously. I mean, I think about my own behavior. If I'm in the bank or if I'm in the grocery store, I am the model of good behavior. I stand in line obediently and I smile and nod politely to others around me. But put me behind the wheel of a car in traffic where I'm anonymous and unaccountable and I'm an animal, right? I'm cutting people off and I'm waiting to get over in that lane that they say lane closed ahead because I have no accountability and no one can see me face to face.
Let me amplify that by reading a section in your book on page 145, which I think is one of the most important pages in your book. And it's under a subtitle called The Round Peg in the Town Square. You basically say, anonymity, I'm quoting, anonymity, bots, algorithms, and different social norms make social media platforms completely distinct from a public forum on a street corner. When one considers how badly the metaphor fits, comparing profit-driven social media platforms to public space is itself a kind of disinformation. Anonymity online is one way in which social media are different from the traditional town square. In the town square, we know who's speaking because we can see and hear them. We base our assessment of arguments in part on the credibility of the speaker. In contrast, some social media platforms permit anonymous accounts, allowing anyone to pose as someone else, period, end quote. Because when you look at all the media that the Trumpsters have got, national, state, local, that the election was stolen, there's an asymmetry between the rebuttal of people saying, where's your evidence? The key phrase, where's your evidence? Where's your authority under law? Are dim and indistinct. Let's start with an easy one. On page 84, you basically have a section that says, insult them to death. And basically, you start with a favorite topic of mine, the unrebutted nicknames that Trump has pejoratively given to friends and foes alike who disagree or oppose him. I'll quote, quote, I cannot remember Trump ever publicly telling a conventional joke or engaging in a politician's standard self-deprecating humor. Instead, he mocks his opponent with demeaning nicknames by calling his political rivals names like, quote, Crooked Hillary, quote, Clinton, or, quote, Sleepy Joe Biden, quote. Trump reduces them to negative caricatures, creating false but enduring impressions. Trump jabbed at Senator Elizabeth Warren's claimed Native American heritage by calling her, quote, Pocahontas, unquote. He also relentlessly targeted any member of his own party who dared to challenge him. He called Texas Senator Ted Cruz, a rival candidate, quote, lying Ted, end quote. He called his own attorney general, who recused himself from the Trump-Russia investigation, quote, Mr. Magoo, after the cartoon character. So how would you respond, if you were a political consultant, how would you respond to his nicknames and his getting away with it? How would you give him some of his own medicine?
So I'm not a political consultant, and I think what I would love to see is not giving people some of their own medicine, because I think it just escalates until we're all in the sewer calling each other's names. You know, I mentioned in the book how others have taken up this mantle by, you know, local politicians engaging in name calling against their opponents. It is such base and demeaning way of engaging in discourse. What I'd rather see is people call this out and talk about how incredibly inappropriate it is to reduce someone to a nickname instead of focusing on solving real problems. You may have legitimate arguments and concerns about your opponent. Maybe they have been hypocritical in their view on positions. Maybe they have held positions that are not in the best interest of the country. Those are all fair game. But to simply call them names is so juvenile and so damaging to democracy. And I think that's what I would point out is, this person is not a serious person who wants to engage in issues. This person wants to hurl insults and bring all of us down to that level.
Is that happening? Is there a rebuttal at your high level of exchange? Democrats, for example, are they engaging in that rebuttal, or is just letting them have free exercise?
I think people are still bewildered about how to respond to Donald Trump. I think the media is bewildered because we've never seen anything like him. He's an absolute disruptor of how our system works. And so he's a big bully who runs around and says all kinds of mean things, and nobody knows how to deal with it. I think the media still struggles to decide, how do you cover someone when we've been trained to give both sides of an argument, which presumes that both sides are engaging in good faith, when instead you have someone who is not engaging in good faith, engaging in lies, making even inconsistent statements. You know, classic example of Donald Trump accusing the FBI of planting evidence in his home, and then later saying he had every right to take those documents that are now in his home. So not even demanding consistency on the arguments he makes. And so I think the media has been confused. Do you cover his rallies, or are you just giving airtime and oxygen to lies? Or do you not cover his rallies where he can say things that then go unrebutted because people aren't even aware of what he is saying other than his supporters? So I'm not sure I know the answer of how best to cover these things, but I think real-time fact-checking of lies is important. And I think criticizing the use of belittling nicknames is the most effective way to push back again, rather than just calling him a name. Then we're all debased.
I agree with you. You don't want to go down in the mud with people. But when the national press begins and continues to be his bullhorn verbatim, repeating it, given no right of reply. There's no way you can simply say, I don't want to go to his level, because the press has raised it to a level that is devastating to our democracy and all the things you have in this book. Did you ever think that you're making too strong a case without inserting more of the rebuttals in the text itself? Because I'm worried about people just saying, it's hopeless, it's over. She's made such a case, there's no way we're going to recover. The internet, uber alles.
Well, no, because the introduction to the book and the last 50 pages of the book talk about solutions. It's actually, I like to think, a hopeful book, a book about remembering what unites us as opposed to what divides us, focusing on the commitments that prior generations have made to defending democracy. And I hope pointing out how important it is that we preserve our institutions like democracy and public safety and the rule of law. So I'm hopeful that what I've done in this book is to help people identify some of these tactics so that they can understand them and avoid being manipulated by them. And then I offer solutions, some that are at the governmental level, like regulating social media and removing dark money from politics. But many of them are at the individual level, like media literacy and giving people some tips for how they can spot false claims when they read them online. But, you know, in the end, I say that if we are going to survive as a democracy, we have to recommit ourselves to truth. So what I'm really hoping to do with this book is to just spark a national conversation about the importance of truth.
Okay, now in the section where you start with the solutions, which you title, We Alone Can Fix It, Proposed Solutions, you have the statement, quote, the tandem threats of authoritarianism and disinformation can seem overwhelming, but we as a nation have solved big problems before. And then you say, we can reduce disinformation from the supply side. We can regulate online publishers like other industries, you know, make them suable for defamation, for example. We can prohibit anonymous users and bots. We can require disclosure of funding sources. Who's the dark money here? We can regulate algorithms. We can end SponCon, fake news stories that are sponsored by advertisers and not disclosed on television and radio. We can subsidize paywalls. We can strengthen local journalism. I'm big on that. We can restore equal time in the fairness doctrine that was rejected under Reagan and the FCC. We can create a code of ethics for social media platforms. We can reduce disinformation from the demand side. You know, the consumer can say, hey, this is nonsense, can reject it. We can promote civic engagement, use and improve online tools, mitigate the harms to democracy, reform campaign finance, protect election machinery, and mitigate the harms to public safety and national security. Now, some of these are self-enforcing by civic awareness and civic response. Some of them might be headed off if we taught civics seriously in our elementary and high school and connected it to civic experience in the community under adult guidance. But most of them require Congress, like to restore the ban on assault weapons, police violent content online, and so forth. But you don't focus on the Congress. Can you tell our listeners what they have to do to get all these recommendations moving by becoming a force on Congress, becoming what we call a Capitol Hill citizen, which is the title of our new newspaper on Congress, which I'd be happy to send you copies of?
Yeah, I'd love to see it. Well, I think that many of these solutions, not all of them, but many of them do require acts of Congress, you know, amending Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act, you know, regulating social media, adjusting the way campaign finance laws work. All of those will require acts of Congress. And so to that extent, you know, we the people hold that power by electing members of Congress who will commit themselves to the truth. We're in dire circumstances here with some members of one party refusing to commit themselves to truth. When people like Liz Cheney and Adam Kinzinger tried to focus on truth, they were purged from their party. And so I think it's going to take some political courage to do that. But if we can elect honorable members of Congress from both parties who are committed to truth, then I think we could begin to make some progress on adjusting some of these laws, which are not dramatic changes in the law, by the way, but things that I think would mitigate the harms of disinformation And I think what mostly we need to do is to demand that we commit ourselves to truth.
Well, you know, you make good points. The Republicans are the leaders in disinformation in Congress on climate violence, on the IRS budget, and what the IRS plans to do with an expanding budget to minimize the Republicans aiding and abetting mass tax evasion by the super rich and corporations. But I've noticed there are some areas where there isn't any disinformation because they're democracy deserts. And corporate crime and corporate welfare. Do you see disinformation on that?
Absolutely, Ralph. That's certainly the case. As a prosecutor prosecuting cases of corporate fraud, I saw the ways that corporations are really benefited in our legal system. I mean, one is the penalties for white-collar crime pale in comparison to the street crimes that are committed by ordinary people. So that's one area where there is a disparity. But I also think that one of the things we have seen in recent years is this effort by some politicians to drive a wedge between white citizens and lower wealth minority citizens. And that is because if you can keep them apart from each other, you can keep whites on your side as a voting bloc, and they will even vote on issues that are against their own self-interest if you can convince them that the real danger to America is immigrants or minorities or the LGBTQ community, and that those are the real threats. And if the politician is going to give corporate tax cuts and tax cuts for the wealthy that makes you less well off financially, then you'll be willing to overlook that because they've convinced you that the real threat is something else. So I do think that there is disinformation out there that is designed to benefit the haves over the have-nots.
What do you think law schools should be doing about this?
I hope opening our eyes to our students, helping them understand how there are disparities that exist in the system, that people will work to manipulate others to preserve their power or to gain power, but that the rule of law is a great tool for achieving equal justice under law.
Any last comments to our listeners that I haven't asked you about you'd like to end with?
I would just say this. Thank you, Ralph, for having me on, and that we need to demand truth. We can't allow ourselves even to engage in fiction, even if we believe it is to advance our ends. The ends can never justify the means. Our country is built on integrity in the rule of law, and we need to demand truth if we're going to have a democracy and effective self-governance.
We've been speaking with Professor Barbara McQuaid, who's often a commentator on MSNBC and other outlets. Her book is Attack from Within: How Disinformation is Sabotaging America. It's rising to bestseller levels. I urge you to read it, give it to your libraries, and incorporate it in your civic discussion at the local level, and keep local newspapers alive. Thank you very much, Barbara McQuaid.
Thank you, Ralph.
We've been speaking with Barbara McQuaid. We will link to Attack from Within at RalphNaderRadioHour.com. Up next, Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson joins us to tell us exactly what he thinks of the people in the U.S. government who are supporting the Israeli genocide in Gaza. But first, let's hear from our corporate crime reporter, Russell Mokyber.
From the National Press Building in Washington, D.C., this is your Corporate Crime Reporter Morning Minute for Friday, March 8, 2024. I'm Russell Mokyber. Family Dollar stores pled guilty last week to holding food, drugs, medical devices, and cosmetics under insanitary conditions related to a rodent infestation at the company's West Memphis, Arkansas distribution center. A criminal information unsealed last week in federal court in Little Rock charged Family Dollar with one misdemeanor count of causing FDA-regulated products to become adulterated while being held under insanitary conditions. The company, a subsidiary of Dollar Tree, entered into a guilty plea agreement that includes a sentence of a fine and forfeiture amount totaling $41 million, the largest ever monetary criminal penalty in a food safety case. For the Corporate Crime Reporter, I'm Russell Mokyber.
Thank you, Russell. Welcome back to the Ralph Nader Radio Hour. My name is Steve Scroven, along with David Feldman and Ralph, for his take on how the Biden administration is dealing with Israel in relation to their relentless bombardment of Gaza. We turn to retired Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson. David?
Lawrence Wilkerson is a retired U.S. Army colonel. Over his 31 years of service, Colonel Wilkerson served as Secretary of State Colin Powell's chief of staff from 2002 to 2005. And special assistant to General Powell when he was chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff from 1989 to 1993. He is currently a senior fellow at the Eisenhower Media Network, senior advisor to the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft, and co-founder of the All Volunteer Force Forum. Welcome back to the Ralph Nader Radio Hour, Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Welcome indeed, Larry. Well, you've had experience in the military and State Department, and what's going on in the U.S. weaponizing the Israeli military, providing political cover at the U.N. with automatic vetoes, Security Council, and other ways making sure our allies don't stray from the Israeli government can do no wrong. Tell us what your appraisal is of our State Department since October 7th, as if history started then. And in the context, we have five federal laws that are being violated by the U.S. government because they are not using them to condition weapons sales to Israel on the basis of human rights and not being used for offensive purposes, all the laws that you're familiar with, and they are not being recognized by the State Department and Secretary of State Blinken. Give us your appraisal of the State Department here, which of course reflects Joe Biden's instructions and position.
There's a lot to unpack in what you just said. Let me try some of it. I think all of the spokespersons, from Admiral Kirby, who absolutely disgust me, to those who speak for the State Department and others who speak it from time to time for the White House, are all singing off essentially the same sheet of music, even when they're disgusting, particularly Kirby. And so I have to believe that Blinken, Sullivan, Kirby, all of them are reflecting not their own views, not their personal views. They may indeed line up with those views, but I don't think they're reflecting that. They're reflecting the president. I can't explain it any other way. I know Biden is a neophyte, vice president for 8 years, but really a neophyte at exercising power from the Oval Office. And I'm not sure he's ever going to learn. And I know he's a fan, not just a fan, but a dear lover of Israel. And so the things that they're saying, the things that they're doing, which half the world at least finds disgusting as I do, if not more so, are being fed to them, I assume, by the president of the United States. Otherwise, I've got to condemn them all of being these hardcore, irascible, stupid, unwise idiots. Kirby, take Kirby, for example, when he talked about the South African application to the court. Now, a good diplomat would have said something like this. Colin Powell would have said something like this. The state of South Africa, recognized by the UN as a legitimate state in the global structure, has a right to do what it's done. We don't necessarily agree with the application, but they certainly have a sovereign right to do what they have done, and then go on from there. No, he used three just horrible adjectives to describe their application right off the bat and dismissed it. Not even thinking, too, that as a good diplomat would, it's predominantly a black state or perceived as a black state, and you're a white man, Admiral Kirby, a very, very unfeeling, apparently, white man. So that's the image they're giving off. And let me tell you that it's not only losing Joe Biden about 100,000 voters every week with regard to his stance on Gaza, but it's also causing the 2 billion plus people in the world to add to its numbers astronomically who absolutely abominate the United States of America and the American empire. That's not good for us. It really isn't good for us. We started it big time with state-sponsored torture. We started it with endless stupid wars in Afghanistan, in Iraq, in Libya, in Syria, and a host of other places that the American people don't even know about. But we're losing, and we're losing big time. As I said, the title of my talk yesterday was American Power at an Inflection Point. And what I said to them was the inflection point, if you will, is downward. We are not just standing at the precipice of the cliff. We're going over from all manner of power parameters. We are going over.
Before we get to the Gaza situation, Larry Wilkerson, let's go back to the Veterans for Peace put out a petition to the State Department to observe five federal laws, which the Biden administration is clearly violating by sending unconditional weaponry and political support to Israel's devastation
Josh Paul has already resigned over that. And Josh Paul resigned over something that when I thought about what he said and did, and I know Josh now, I probably should have resigned over too. I used to attend Link Bloomfield's meetings in the mornings at Richard Haass's request when I was on the policy planning staff at the State Department. And it hardly passed that something didn't happen with a country that was using U.S. munitions that violated significantly, in some cases with Israel in particular, the law. I remember one morning when we sat down and we were acquainted with immediately a strike that the Israelis had made with an Apache helicopter, AH-64 helicopter, and Hellfire missiles, killing people in a hotel room, and some of those people, women and children. That automatically violated U.S. laws and at least called for demarche to the Israeli embassy, if not more significant action. And if you followed the law to the letter of the law, you would cease selling that equipment to those people. We never did. We didn't even demarche. That's how much of a hold AIPAC and the state of Israel in particular has over the United States Congress, over our laws, over our White House, over everything meaningful in this country with regard to leadership and national security. AIPAC owns it in many respects. They own it.
Well, the protests own the streets, and AIPAC and their cohorts own the suites, the Congress and the White House. How do you characterize the completely out of control Israeli military assault on Gaza and its 2.3 million inhabitants after declaring on October 8th by the Ministry of Defense, they're human animals, no food, no medicine, no water, no electricity, no fuel. We're going to act accordingly. Is there a command and control structure over the military, the pilots, the tank commanders, and the snipers? And what's going on there? Because it seems like they're on the way to eradicating by starvation and by violating international law that when you control an area militarily, you have to protect the civilian population. Instead of protecting them, they're eradicating men, women, and children, mostly women and children. How do you characterize it as a former military man?
And don't forget, they dropped 2,000-pound bombs on buildings. They are just people killers. I mean, they're indiscriminate. They do not necessarily say, I'm going after you, Hamas. They go after everybody in that building. And so as Gilead Levy has pointed out a number of times at Haaretz, the United States is just as guilty as Israel. Every bomb that's dropped is from the United States, as it were. And all the munitions that they're using now out of our war reserve stocks in their own country, the largest, I think, of our war reserve stocks, it's our fault. We're aiding and abetting this happening. So everything you've said, just put it at the doorstep of the United States, too. The IDF started this in a big way. It's not that they haven't been doing it all along in piecemeal fashion, but they started it in a big way in Operation Cast Lead, if you remember that. I happened to have a student in my George Washington University seminar who'd served in the IDF and who gave us a sort of personal appreciation of what happened during that operation. You actually had
a date.
It was back in, 2011, I think, or so. It only took about 23 days, but go back and look at it. There is some video. Go back and look at the write-ups. It was a precursor for this. It was a short precursor for this. And the instructions to the soldiers were to kill everything that moved, because you may recall that sometime earlier, Hezbollah had given Israel and the IDF a little bit of a black mark. They had embarrassed them. They had pretty much stood them off. And so this operation was conducted in part, at least, to demonstrate to everyone in the region that you didn't mess with the IDF. And the way they do that is they kill everything in sight, women, dogs, cats, children, whatever. What the IDF is doing now is augmented by and led by, if you will, because when Israel goes to war, they let the people in the field dictate what happens in the field. Unlike us, we keep a civilian chain of command. With this group, though, Netanyahu is very much in charge. And what's happening from the extreme in Likud is that their policies are being implemented because they have threatened him with breaking away from his government if he doesn't go along with it. Not that I don't think from time to time Netanyahu isn't one of them, too, but he has no choice. Otherwise, he's going to jail. His coalition will break up and he'll go to jail. So they are carrying this out as they have slowly and surely in the West Bank and beginning in East Jerusalem, in Gaza, on a large scale. And I have no doubt, and I've already got reports from northern Gaza that this is happening even as I speak, that Ben-Gvir and his people are already ready to start settling Gaza just as soon as they can get into any part of it, probably in the north first, and begin to settle it, just as they've been doing in the West Bank and just as they're now doing in East Jerusalem. So the purpose of this whole operation is to set as much territory up as possible for the settlers, Ben-Gvir and his boys, to get in there and to do what they do, which is build settlements that then become nice places to live, that then become Hollywood Hills with Audubons and everything else. Go look at the West Bank, for example. That's what they're doing. And now they're doing it because of October the 7th. They were given sort of the 9/11 impetus that we had. They were given the wherewithal to do it wholesalely, and that's what they're doing.
Well, let's talk about casualty figures here. There's something that Netanyahu and Hamas have in common. Of course, we should always remember Netanyahu for years bragged about supporting and facilitating the funding of Hamas because it opposes a two-state solution supported by the Palestinian Authority. Is there such a vast undercount of the deaths? My best appraisal, Larry, is that there's already been 200,000 fatalities. You have 5,000 babies born every month into the rubble with no health care, for example. Mothers unable to feed their infants. What's your view on this adoption by friend and foe alike in the Western media and civic groups, all using the Hamas health ministry's figures, which are absurdly low?
Whatever they're going to use is going to be the lowest figures they can find. I mean, I look at the New York Times, for example. Just you read the New York Times. The New York Times is an Israeli agent in all practical ways. The media is an Israeli agent. When they do give some kind of deference to the other side, as it were, it's always in words and terminology and short sentences that make you know that they are balanced. They are fair and balanced. They're about as fair and balanced as my left foot. That's the way it is. The purpose here is eradication, elimination, or expulsion, period. Eradication, elimination, or expulsion. When they
You're
run
not talking about the Israeli government.
I'm talking about the Israeli government vis-a-vis the Palestinians. Eradication, expulsion, elimination, pick your verb that means essentially the same thing.
Would you describe this as Israeli state terrorism on a grand scale?
Absolutely. I'm with Erdogan there. Erdogan has told his parliament time and time again that Benjamin Netanyahu is a terrorist.
So what do you think is going to happen if the Palestinians are not even allowed to count their dead accurately? They can't bury their dead. They can't surrender. They can't flee. They're trapped. There's no food and no water. Would you call this the Palestinian Holocaust?
Yes. Again, eradication, expulsion, elimination, pick your verb. That is the purpose of this operation. And if they stop short, then Netanyahu will just pass it on to the next leader because they are going to stop short in terms of eliminating Hamas. That's an impossibility. His strategic objectives, all of them, are impossible. But he doesn't care because he'll be gone and hopefully he'll be kept out of jail. I'm sure that's the way he feels about it. It reminds me of Donald Rumsfeld when Powell's lawyer asked him, "Do you know, Mr. Secretary, you have a 13-year-old down there in Guantanamo?" "Yeah." "Well, are you prepared to keep him there for 70 years? He might live that long." "Oh, we'll cross that bridge when we get to it." Donald Rumsfeld's dead now. He doesn't have to cross that bridge. And we still have people in Guantanamo. This is just that sort of thing on a much larger scale, including massacre and genocide.
Well, just for our listeners, when Larry Wilkerson talks about Netanyahu going to jail, it's because he's been under serious corruption charges by Israeli prosecutors for years. And what's keeping him out of jail is his position as prime minister. So he has an interest in prolonging the war. As long as he prolongs the war, he can defer the culmination of the prosecution against him for corruption. So what do you see coming here? You see a larger war? You see the U.S. playing the game Israel wants to play by bombing and Iraq and Syria and threatening Iran. What's the likelihood of a larger war?
Netanyahu knows from his top generals that he has to do one of two things or both of them in order to conduct the ground offensive he wants to conduct against Rafah. He has to redeploy troops within Gaza, or he has to call up a sizable amount of new reservists, or both. That's going to take him, and he's said this over and over again, not explicitly, but he's got to take a breather here. He's got to do all this. Well, in that breather, he's got time to think about what you just pointed out, that if he had a wider war, if he had other enemies, if he was more hard-pressed, really genuinely hard-pressed, then the United States would be in for a penny, in for a pound. So what does he do? He looks over at Nasrallah. He looks over at Iran. And he says about Hezbollah, well, I think maybe I'll widen the war to Hezbollah. They don't want it. Nasrallah doesn't want it. Iran doesn't want it. And Iran certainly doesn't want an attack on it. But what has been Bibi Netanyahu's strategic purpose vis-a-vis the United States ever since he was finance minister? Over 20 years to get the United States to attack Iran. So yes, I do see a very pregnant possibility that he might widen this war between now and Ramadan, as he says.
Let's talk about the military operation in Gaza. What's the strategy here? There doesn't seem to be much resistance by Hamas. They're hunkering down in the tunnel system. Israeli casualties are minimal by their own standards.
They're pretty high.
What's going on there?
Those are being lied about, too. Israeli casualties, I'm being told by reputable sources, are pretty high. Higher than they've ever been in an Israeli military operation like this before.
Well, certainly they can fudge the injury level and friendly fire level, but they can't fudge the fatalities. Yep. There are about 260 fatalities.
I'm told it's double that. I don't have any way of confirming that, but I'm told it's double that. Just as in Ukraine, I'm told it's double what Zelensky is putting out.
What do you think? This is not a war in Gaza. It's just a one-sided, devastating attack. There's hardly any resistance other than, you know, a few popping up here and there from the tunnel entrances or exits. What's the nature of the fighting here, other than demolishing the whole place day by day?
I think there's more opposition than you're hinting at there. And there's also, you know, in Afghanistan and Iraq, in World War II, hell, in any conflict, you get as many, if not more, in Afghanistan, you got more casualties from, quote, non-hostile action, unquote, than you do from the actual conflict itself. Tanks run over people, armored cars run over people, buildings fall on people. You shoot your own troops. You don't mean to, but you do, because combat is tough stuff. So the casualties are never what we say they are. In the United States, we say KIA and WIA based on what happens in the course of the war. We don't give the non-hostile action deaths out, which exceed the war deaths, except every now and then. And then when you look at them and you say, well, what's this? Why did this happen? Well, a helicopter crashed. Well, a tank ran into a building. Well, that armored car turned over and fell into a wadi. You take more casualties from non-hostile action than you do from hostile action.
Let's turn to Trump in the election.
I'm not nearly as worried about Trump being president again if he is elected as some people are, because I believe in our checks and balances, and I believe in the ability of the American people to recognize a scoundrel finally and do something about it. Secondarily, I don't believe he's going to be elected. Now, let me say, I think the choice the American people face is abysmal, absolutely abysmal. One of the things we concluded yesterday in our seminar was that is the case, and it probably is known by at least 60% of the electorate. They don't have any choice. Either side they go to is warmongering, locked up with the oligarchs, moneyed to the hilt, and driven by everything but the American national security interest and the American domestic interest. They aren't driven by that. All you have to do is look at the borders, look at what we're doing with Ukraine. Do you know what Dwight Eisenhower did with Hungary when a similar thing happened in 56 and what LBJ did with Czechoslovakia when a similar thing happened in 68? We didn't throw billions of dollars into the defense of Hungary or the defense of Czechoslovakia. We knew it would be utterly absurd to do so. Now look what we're doing with Ukraine. We have no leadership, Ralph. We have incompetence across the board.
Tell us what President Eisenhower did when the French, British, and Israeli Air Force were attacking Nasser in Egypt because he had just nationalized the Suez Canal.
Well, he picked up the phone and told his diplomats, including Dulles, to tell them all to get out and to get out ASAP, as soon as possible. The Israelis drug their feet and tried to stay. He gave them an ultimatum finally that said, if you don't get out, you are going to have real problems with the United States of America. And so they finally did get out. But it was a completely different time then and a completely different man. Dwight Eisenhower was arguably the only really experienced, talented, competent leader we've had from the 1945 to 2024 period.
And it's been all downhill in the White House since then in terms of standing up for America's national interest, world peace, and holding the regime over there accountable. Now, you speak to a lot of gatherings in Washington and around the country. What else would you like to tell our listeners that we haven't asked you about?
That they need to wake up. We all need to wake up, and we need to start taking action such as we can, locally, whatever, whatever's within our purview and power to do, because we're losing this country. We're losing it to the moneyed oligarchy. We're losing it to the unprecedented amount of money because of Citizens United that's pouring into the political coffers of people who have no interest in what you want. Gun control, whatever it might be that you want, you muster your majorities. It doesn't matter because these people are basing their decisions on money, money, not you. They're not the people's representatives. They're the representatives of the deep state, which is the oligarchy, not the bureaucracy within the federal government. It's the oligarchy. It's the Elon Musk. It's the Thiels. It's all these people with these unprecedented amounts of money who can influence anything, anytime they want to with a few telephone calls. That's what's running your country. And the predatory capitalism that they're advancing is running the world into the ground, which is why a lot of the world is deciding that if I got a choice between the Chinese and the offer they're making and the Americans and the offers they've been making for years now, I'm going to pick the Chinese. That's a dangerous way to do business in the world. And we need to wake up and do something about it.
The first step of waking up, what do you think of people presenting well-informed petitions to members of Congress to come back home for town meetings arranged by the people, with a lot of left-right civic support, I might add, so they can be challenged and instructed in town meetings and answer questions without intermediary people and assistants getting in the way. What do you think of a summons of the people to members, senators, representatives to come back to town meetings?
I think that's a great idea. And I'll just cite one example. We had a meeting in Texas with the Texas government about climate change and a revenue neutral carbon tax. And we actually got floored essentially by the Speaker of the Texas House, who listened and then started to take action. Well, part of that was taking action with their two senators in Washington and some of the representatives. Long story short, we managed to get into their offices and we managed to talk to them. And they said, well, we're going back and we're going to see. We're going to Houston. We're going to McAllen. We're going to Dallas, Fort Worth. And so we're going to see what the people think. And they came back and said, my God, you're right. We went back to those town hall meetings and these people are concerned about hurricanes coming up the ship channel and all this other stuff. That's probably the most important thing you can do. Either come to Washington in a constituent visit and put your desires on the table in front of your member, or get them all back, even better, as Ralph said, in their places and in their towns and villages and meet and hammer them and hammer them and hammer them again. Let them know what you want and let them know you're going to unelect them if they don't do it.
Well, over 1 million acres of Texas land has already been burned, the biggest fire in Texas history linked to global warming and the climate catastrophe. So it's coming home in very, very visceral ways to people that will overcome whatever preordained ideological views they may have. You know, it's the reality that's probably beginning to change opinions even in southern red states like Texas, wouldn't you say?
Yes. And when we showed them the analysis that Rand had made of a Cat 4, not even a Cat 5, but a Cat 4 hurricane coming up a certain way through the ship channel, and the billions of dollars of damage and the thousands of lives it would probably cost, we got their attention.
Well, this is a very encouraging note to close on. We've been talking with retired Colonel Larry Wilkerson, who has taught at a number of colleges and speaks from his experience and has revisited some of the decisions he made with Colin Powell and is a leading spokesperson now for peace and justice domestically and around the world, and calls them as he sees them. Thank you very much, Larry.
Thank you, Ralph.
We've been speaking to Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson. We will link to his work at RalphNaderRadioHour.com. I want to thank our guests again today, Barbara McQuaid and Lawrence Wilkerson. For those of you listening on the radio, that's our show. For you podcast listeners, stay tuned for some bonus material. You all know we call it The Wrap-Up, featuring Francesco DeSantis with In Case You Haven't Heard, and a wider-ranging discussion with Colonel Wilkerson. A transcript of this program will appear on the Ralph Nader Radio Hour Substack site soon after the episode is posted.
Subscribe to us on our Ralph Nader Radio Hour YouTube channel. And for Ralph's weekly column, it's free. Go to Nader.org. For more from Russell Mochiver, go to CorporateCrimeReporter.com.
The American Museum of Tort Law has gone virtual. Go to TortMuseum.org to explore the exhibits, take a virtual tour, and learn about iconic tort cases from history.
We have a new issue of the Capitol Hill Citizen. It's out now. To order your copy of the Capitol Hill Citizen, Democracy Dies in Broad Daylight, go to CapitolHillCitizen.com.
And remember, to continue the conversation after each show, go to the comments section at RalphNaderRadioHour.com and post a comment or question on this week's episode.
The producers of the Ralph Nader Radio Hour are Jimmy Lee Wirt and Matthew Marin. Our executive producer is Alan Minsky.
Our theme music, Stand Up, Rise Up, was written and performed by Kemp Harris. Our proofreader is Elizabeth Solomon. Our associate producer is Hannah Feldman. Our social media manager is Stephen Wendt.
Join us next week on the Ralph Nader Radio Hour. Thank you, Ralph.
Thank you. The demand for the brand new issue of Capital Citizen is running out of supply. We're going to have to reprint. Go for CapitalCitizen.com and become a Capitol Hill citizen yourself when you get this 40 pages of print only.
Hi, this is Jimmy Lee Wirt, and welcome to The Wrap-Up. First, Ralph has a little bit more to say about rebuting Donald Trump.
What's the nature of the retired military going to be on the Trump campaign? He's already said if he gets elected, he's going after former Secretary of Defense Mattis, former Chairman of Joint Chiefs of Staff Mark Milley. He's going to go after his National Security Advisor, former General Kelly. What's the ferment among the military? Because here's a president who's going to use the Insurrection Act, using armed forces to suppress domestic protests. He's made no bones about that. There are other statutes that are without standards or congressional oversight that he can use to turn himself into Der Führer Donald as a dictator. I would think that the opposition in the military to Trump in his later months as president augur well for their networking opposition to his candidacy, because these generals I just mentioned and many others have large circles of support and admirers. Are they just laying back and watching events relentlessly unfold to November, or are they organizing opposition here?
I hope that they're doing, and I pray that they're doing what they should be doing, which is not getting involved in politics. And you're suggesting that they should get involved in politics is anathema to me and would be anathema to any military officer, flag or not. Now, as far as H.R. McMaster and John Kelly and Mattis and others go, I'm sure they're just quaking in their boots at Trump's threats against them. Are they going to do something in their circles to influence people against Trump? Perhaps, but they're not going to be public about it. That's the worst thing they could possibly do. The worst thing we could have is that the military divide into rank and file here, there, and elsewhere, and flags here, there, and elsewhere, and start an internecine struggle within the military ranks. That's the last thing we need. So let's be careful with our rhetoric and be careful with the accusations we throw around.
And now we continue our conversation with Colonel Wilkerson over a wide range of issues.
Explain to our listeners who aren't familiar with the Israeli attack on the USS Liberty in 1967.
Well, it's still much contested, except by the crew of the Liberty, who are still alive, and by a few people who are around it who've made great studies of it, if you will. As best as I can tell, the Israelis did not mistake a U.S. intelligence gathering ship in the Mediterranean for an enemy ship. They actually attacked the ship, willfully attacked the ship, even when sailors were in the water abandoning the ship, shooting the sailors in the water, because they were fearful of something that the ship might have intercepted that involved their prosecution of the war they were currently involved in. And so they did what they did. What people don't talk about, for example, that reinforces and ramifies this view in my mind, is that the Israelis have paid reparations, fairly significant reparations, in the interim. We kept that very quiet, but they did. And they almost admitted, at least to some guilt for what had happened, you know, mistaken identity, that sort of thing. But you can't buy the IDF and the particularly the Air Force being super competent, and then at the same time buy the fact that they not only rolled in on these men in the water and shot them up, but they did it several times. And they attacked the ship when the ship was clearly a U.S. vessel. So that's a crime at the feet of the commission that was put together to study it afterwards. It's a crime at the feet of the United States president, who more or less condoned it and let it rest. And I have from some of the survivors that they've all received letters and telephone calls and things like that, that lead them to believe indirectly, if not directly, in some cases directly, that they should keep their mouths shut and stop talking. I happen to have.
The surprising thing is the U.S. Navy, led by Senator John McCain's father, who was an admiral at the time, engaged in the cover-up that Lyndon Baines Johnson constructed. 38 sailors were killed in this attack and dozens more injured.
Yes.
On the SS Liberty, and there are many good books written on it. But it just illustrates the lack of a countervailing pressure on Congress and the White House in matters relating to the Middle East, and how frequent the Congress basically surrenders its constitutional authority and statutory authority when it comes to Israeli government demands on it.
Ralph, there's a book coming out. In fact, the book just got through the Pentagon's clearance process. It has some redactions. It's called Deadly Betrayal, and it's written by Man Chief Master Sergeant of the U.S. Air Force, Dennis Fritz, who once upon retirement went into Douglas Feist's shop, Undersecretary of Defense for Policy for Donald Rumsfeld, during the Iraq and Afghan wars. He will tell you in that book, and this part doesn't get redacted, as far as I know, it hasn't been, that Douglas Feith, the number three man in the Defense Department, Undersecretary of Defense for Policy, was surrounded 8, 10, 12, 14, 16 hours a day by Mossad agents, that the entire office was given over to Mossad agents, that Mossad agents had as much to do with what happened in Iraq as anybody else. And there's a lot of other things in that book that are going to surprise a lot of Americans if they bother to read it.
Explain Mossad.
Mossad is the equivalent of the CIA for the Israelis.
Let's take you into the Pentagon budget. You go up on Capitol Hill a lot, try to get some rational policies. It's an unaudited budget violating federal law since 1992, as I've said on this program, requiring all departments and agencies to supply an annual audited budget to Congress, and the Pentagon is the only one that hasn't done it since 1992, and every Secretary of Defense has conceded that they have not done an audited budget and that they will do it, and it will take billions of dollars for the auditors and 5 years, and then there's a new Secretary of Defense, and the merry-go-round starts all over again. Well, now you have both parties supporting an ever larger military budget and giving the generals billions of dollars every year, more than they even asked for, via the White House Office of Budget. What's going on at Capitol Hill now? There are hardly any serious hearings on the military budget. Both the Democrats and Republicans are locking arms, giving the Pentagon more money than asked for. What's going on there?
Well, what's going on is what's been going on for now at least 20 years, maybe longer, probably ever since I entered the senior ranks of the military. And that is that the big guys, and they're very few now, and so it's a monopoly. It's a predatory capitalist monopoly now. Lockheed Martin, Boeing, Grumman, Raytheon, you can name them. They feed so much money back into the packs of the heads of the committees that deal with the military that all you get is people who never met a defense program they didn't want to fund and even add to. That's part of it. All this money flowing back from very, very wealthy defense contractors now after 20 plus years of war into the coffers of the various congressmen who vote on the policies and budgets of the military. So that's the number one reason. The number two reason is because, and we have blown this out of the water. We blew it out of the water when Powell was chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, but it's being blown out again by everything from POGO to Win Without War. And that is that a military dollar in a community, this is the other reason congressmen are so for the military, is a one-for-one dollar. What do I mean by that? I mean, it is a one-for-one multiplier. You put a dollar in for the military in San Diego, and it's a dollar. You put four health dollars in, and it's $10. You put two education dollars in, and it's $12. You put two local government dollars in, and it's $2 or $3 or $4. Any other purpose you put the money in for that's a legitimate social or what you might call civil purpose multiplies itself. Even an entrepreneurial dollar is $4 to $6 on top of the one invested. With all the faults and failures you have, it's still $4 to $6 on top of the one invested. The military dollar, coming back to it again, is a one-for-one. And that's been a fact for a long time. So it makes no sense to say, the congressman who says, oh man, I got to have the money for my district to get reelected. Maybe it makes sense for the John Murtha in the small place in Pennsylvania where it really is a number of his votes. But in terms of the National Congress and all the states, it's nonsense to say that military spending makes jobs. It doesn't. It simply doesn't. It makes the few jobs that make military equipment.
What he's saying, listeners, is that public investment in infrastructure creates far more jobs than investment in more Trident submarines or F-35s.
When we reduced the military in 91 and 92 by 25% at H.W. Bush's directions, we went out to mayors and governors all across the country, and we told them, look, we're going to shut this base down. We're going to shut this wharf down. We're going to shut this pier down. We're going to shut this sub pen down, whatever it was. And they ranted and raved for a while. And then the cards and letters started coming in about the end of Powell's chairmanship and kept coming in after that. Oh, man, it was the best thing we ever did to close that base. It was the best thing we ever did to close Wharf 4 in Newport, Rhode Island. Because all kinds of civilian investment then fell in on the property or whatever it was. And suddenly you had more income, more jobs, and a better economy. So shutting down the military is not bad for the economy.
Let's take a closer look at nuclear-powered submarines and General Dynamics out of Groton in Connecticut. Tell our listeners about the Trident submarine, multiple warheads, how many cities can be wiped out by one submarine, how many of these Trident submarines we have, and why do they still build them?
Well, you picked the wrong platform to talk to me about because I made submarines a real subject of my study at the Naval War College when I was there twice as a junior, then a senior. And I've made a study of them ever since. And I even went into Powell when he wanted to cut the submarine force and took Admiral Dave Jeremiah with me and said, Mr. Chairman, don't cut the submarine force. And here's the reasons for that. If I had to keep anything in the way of a nuclear deterrent, now I'd like to get rid of all nuclear weapons, but the last ones I'd get rid of would be those on the submarines because they are invulnerable. And they also mean you can save a hell of a lot of money if you're wise and smart by eliminating land-based missiles. They're just nothing but a sink for the enemy's missiles because they know where they are. And eliminating air-delivered missiles. You don't need those either. You could get away with just 300 or 400 warheads on submarines, and that you would still have the deterrence we have today with them. And if you talk the others, Russia, China, into, which is what we were doing in 91 and 92, not building out their complexes even more, but bringing them down. Ralph, we came down from 31,000 on the Russian side and about 29,000 on our side to about 5,000 a day. And we were going to 1,000 on each side, or 1,200 on each side.
You're talking nuclear bombs.
Yes, yes. We were destroying Russian warheads. We were feverishly destroying them. The lawyers got involved on liability issues and slowed us down, which frustrated Powell to the maximum and also Bush. But we were destroying warheads. We took them down from roughly 31,000 down to around 6,000.
Listen, is this under the arms control treaty with Soviet Union and later Russia? Inspectors were in each other's country monitoring the destruction of nuclear missiles to get down to the level Larry just mentioned. Go ahead.
And then the Moscow Treaty, which Powell went to Bush, George W. Bush, in 2002, when he so summarily abrogated the ABM Treaty, which Powell thought was idiotic, we raced off to Moscow. He sent John Bolton, which I thought was really poetic justice. He sent John Bolton to Moscow to negotiate the Moscow Treaty, two-page treaty that essentially said we were going to keep going down to a range of 1,200 to 2,100 missiles. So we were not going to arrest or stop that progress on destroying the two worst stockpiles in the world of nuclear warheads. And at that time, of course, others, China might have had 400 to 600. Other countries might have had somewhere in that neighborhood. So we were getting down, I won't say reasonable levels, because there is no reasonable level of nuclear weapons, but we were getting down to levels that were far more manageable and, more importantly, far less dangerous in terms of accidents or, you know, first use or whatever. And all of a sudden we stopped. And that history is unknown out in America. It is absolutely unknown. I go places to talk and people look at me like I've got frogs jumping out of my eyes. They don't understand. We were destroying Russian warheads? Yes, ma'am. We certainly were.
Well, our listeners know it now. Can we go to our questions, Steve?
Yes, Colonel Wilkerson, to get back to the Gaza situation. People will say, you know, if Hamas just released the hostages, then all of this would end. What would you say to that?
I would say that that's counterintuitive with an understanding which puts humanitarian interests aside on both ends of this war spectrum. That's counterintuitive to what the other side is going to be motivated to do, because they are in the conflict for reasons. And those reasons are that the Palestinians do not have a state. And those reasons are that the Hamas, in particular, the leadership, at least it says, abominates the state of Israel. And those reasons are significant for them. And they're not going to surrender those reasons, for which they are possibly dying, some are dying, unless they think they are at some advantage, or at least it's a neutral exchange, which is what I think we're trying to negotiate, is an exchange that both sides think is positive for them, or at least neutral and not negative.
Steve, the Israelis every day are taking hostages. They're called prisoners, teenagers throwing rocks at Israeli tanks in the West Bank,
shooting
women in prison. And this business of exchanging hostages for prisoners, they're hostages in the thousands in Israeli jails as well.
That's right.
David?
Thank you. Colonel, are Republicans in the House rooting against Ukraine and for Russia? And is there any legitimate reason for that other than being owned by Vladimir Putin?
I don't think there are ones, not that I know or that I follow in any way, like Johnson, who right now to me is the most mercurial figure in the House. Can't figure him out. One minute I think I know him and don't like him at all, and the next minute he says something that's pretty smart. I don't think anybody in there is a fan of Vladimir Putin. There may be some people who actually think this is all stupid, that harken back to when we were talking with Gorbachev and Shevardnadze, and we were going to be, you know, wasn't going to be kumbaya, but Russia was going to be a member of NATO. It was going to be a member of the political and the military alliance, and maybe even ultimately make the 740 million Europeans who now have a GDP combined and equivalent of ours or surpassing it even more. In other words, Russia from the Urals west, at least, was coming into Europe big time. So they look back on that with some fondness, and they don't understand why we're doing what we're doing right now. But those are few, very few. I'd say less than half a dozen. But I don't think anyone is really on Russia's side in this conflict. I think what Johnson said the other day was fairly astute. It resonated with me anyway. It's about time we spent a lot of this money on the American people.
I actually do have a question. I was planning on being Palestine. I was going to be an observer state, but I do have a question. The U.S. likes to stick its nose into other countries' business and generally makes things worse. At what point should we just stand down and stop meddling, stop involving ourselves in other countries' affairs with the military?
That's a marvelous question. It just rebounded off the walls yesterday in the seminar with these mid-level bureaucrats from all the agencies and different places in the federal bureaucracy. I read to them from Fred Hartman's book, The Relations of Nations, where Dean Acheson, really the only Secretary of State in the 20th century that I think really was a superb diplomat. George Marshall actually recommended to Harry Truman that Dean Acheson replace him when he left. And he said to Truman, he's better than I am. And Marshall was pretty solid character. Acheson describes us, and he describes us in about 45, 50 eloquent sentences that are just magnificent. It's a sweep of our history. We had empires all around us, the Spanish, the Russian, the British, the French. And so we were kept in check. We stayed concentrated on our own manifest destiny, as it were. And then we made some two sorties into the world, World War I, where we made a lot of money, and World War II, where we came out the new Rome. And ever since, we have been insane. But our insanity was put in check by a fellow ideology, or an opposing ideology, communism, and an opposing fairly powerful military. And so it stayed in stasis for, you know, the twilight struggle of the Cold War. But then came the end and the unipolar moment. And we screwed it up big time. And then 9/11 gave an element within our political structure, the neoconservatives, new life, new vigor, and put them in charge of so many positions in the government that we now are still suffering from it. Along came Donald Trump and exacerbated the whole thing, because a lot of Americans intuited some of this, realized things weren't going the way they should, and were looking for a savior. And that's what they found in Donald Trump. It's a cult. It's a religious cult. It's not a political party, as it were. It's a cult. Now we're suffering from all of that. And we have as much chance of losing our external power, as it were, as we do of fracturing inside our own country. And not to mention the debt, the extraordinary debt we're in now. So Americans are worried out there in the hinterland, but they don't know what is the specific concern to put their finger on, other than something that's local or right beside them or whatever. But they have this real unease going now. And it's reflected in all the polls. Doesn't matter whether their position is a positive one or a negative one. They all feel this malaise, as Jimmy Carter used that term so famously. But it's real now. And they feel it, and they don't know what to do about it. So they turn to things, solutions, magic solutions like Donald Trump.
Tell our listeners how many bases we have in how many countries.
You know, we were looking at it the other day because we have closed a couple. There seems to be a more of a tendency for the Congress to think about closing overseas bases than domestic ones. So we've been really harping on that. But we're still around 745, 746 that I would call bases. Not just a gas station somewhere. I think the rest of the world, we counted it up, the rest of the world has maybe 83 or 84. That includes Russia, China, and so forth.
How many countries?
Almost every one of them that you would call neutral or friend or ally. Almost every one of them.
That means over 100.
Yep. I think the count was something like 111.
We have 26 military installations in the Middle East. We have an arsenal in Israel.
It's incredible. We said, after Carter declared the Persian Gulf a vital interest, we said, right, but no military forces on the ground in the Levant, period. And we stuck to that right up to Powell's chairmanship. And then all of a sudden, after Desert Storm, Desert Shield, all of a sudden we started sending in troops. And you know how it goes with the bureaucracy. Central Command had to have, ooh, we're in Florida. We don't like that. We want to be in the region. And the Navy said, oh, we need a fleet in the region. So Bahrain now has the fifth fleet, the largest. We have more forces in the Middle East now than we have any other place in the world.
I meant to ask you this when we were talking about Congress. Is it true that the Pentagon has offices in the House of Representatives and the Senate? What's the nature of them? And what do you think of that in the separation of powers?
Absolutely. It was one of the coveted positions for certain people, like John Kelly, for example, for the Marine Corps. You go over there and you're in that office and you liaison with everybody on the Hill all the time, 24, you know, the military, 24/7, you're over there. You're down in the hidey hole with the senator. You know, you want this program, you're down there working on it, and you're working on it all the time. Your next star or your next promotion comes from how successful you are working those members of Congress.
And what do you think of members of Congress being in the military reserves from a point of view of separation of powers between the executive and Congress?
I have mixed emotions about it. I've known many of them and had occasion to be friends with several of them, and they are good citizen soldiers in most respects, so I have a lot of respect for the fact that they have the job they have. These are mostly staff, professional, primary, and also personal. And to do what they have to do to maintain their bona fides as a reservist or a guardsman is challenging. They have to go to school at night to pass the command and general staff course or the advanced course or the war college or whatever. So I have a lot of admiration for most of them that I know. They're talented people doing two jobs at one time, and there's no conflict of interest there as far as I can tell. And most of them are very ethical about what they discuss and what they don't discuss if they're military affiliation has anything to do with it. So the ones I've known, Ralph, are pretty decent people.
But you say you have mixed feelings on it. What's
I have mixed feelings about it for the very principle that you just stated. I have mixed feelings about Dick Cheney. Dick Cheney spent more time in the Congress than any vice president in history. I had one congressman come up to me and tell me, you need to get this man out of the Congress. This is violation of the Constitution. Now, Cheney's comeback was, oh, I have to come over here to vote. You were over there a lot more than you needed to be just to vote. He would go over there and he would bend arms as vice president of the United States. That's far more dangerous than a guardsman or a reservist as a staffer.
And now it's time for In Case You Haven't Heard with Francesco DeSantis.
Just before the Michigan primary, President Biden implied that a ceasefire in Gaza was imminent. However, many believed at the time that Biden was simply trying to blunt the potency of the uncommitted vote in that contest. The promised ceasefire never materialized, apparently confirming those suspicions. Yet, with uncommitted winning over 100,000 votes in Michigan, the administration has begun using ceasefire language, a major rhetorical shift, but seemingly one without much corresponding action. Phyllis Bennis, writing in Al Jazeera, argues that, quote, whatever the language of Washington's proposed UN Security Council resolution, and likely the possible temporary truce deal as well, the words of National Security Council spokesperson John Kirby continue to resonate as a better reflection of the Biden administration's policy. We're going to continue to support Israel, and we're going to continue to make sure they have the tools and the capabilities to do that. Following the self-immolation of Aaron Bushnell, activist Talia Jane has shared a letter from active-duty U.S. military personnel calling for a ceasefire in Gaza. In this letter, the anonymous signatories write, quote, it is undeniably evident that the Israeli Defense Forces are repeatedly and systematically committing war crimes in Gaza. Support for the conduct of the IDF is unacceptable and inconsistent with our values in the U.S. Armed Forces, end quote. Talia Jane reports that, quote, over 100 active duty military across Air Force, Navy, Army, Marine Corps, Coast Guard, as well as reservists and National Guard and their families have endorsed this open letter. J Street, the preeminent liberal Zionist group, has finally begun using the word ceasefire, while still only supporting a temporary truce. In a note to their members, J Street wrote, quote, this move is not a change in policy. It is a decision to begin using a word that is fraught with meaning and implications in the context of the Gaza war, end quote, Daniel Marins of the Huffington Post reports. J Street has deep ties to the administration, so whether they are taking their cues from the administration and characterizing a temporary truce as a ceasefire, or vice versa, it is significant that this is the new line from mainstream liberal Zionists. Max Tanney of Semaphore reports that the News Guild of New York has sent a letter to the New York Times accusing the Gray Lady of racially profiling their staff as they seek to hunt down the source of a leak exposing their shoddy, possibly completely false, reporting on sexual violence committed by Hamas. Per the letter, quote, "Management's investigators have questioned employees about their involvement in the Times Internal Middle Eastern and North African Times Employee Resource Group, known as the MENA Collective, ordered them to hand over the names of all the MENA Collective's active members involved in group discussions, and demanded copies of personal communications between colleagues about their shared workplace concerns. The Guild intends to vigorously defend our members and their rights and ensure that all our members are protected in a workplace free from harassment and racial profiling." According to NBC News, quote, "The biggest labor union in Washington state endorsed voting uncommitted in the state's Democratic presidential primary next month, citing concerns about President Joe Biden's political strength and his support for Israel's war in Gaza," end quote. UFCW Local 3000 has over 50,000 members, making it the largest state chapter of the United Food and Commercial Workers Union. NBC also reports that, quote, "The Stranger, a prominent alt-weekly publication based in Seattle, also endorsed the idea of voting uncommitted, expressing disappointment in the options of Trump and Biden, whom it referred to as the, quote, two genocidal geriatrics leading the polls." Amid humiliatingly low poll numbers, Democratic-turned-independent Senator Kyrsten Sinema has dropped out of the 2024 Arizona Senate race, the Arizona Republic reports. Senator Sinema, you will not be missed. In Manhattan, over two-thirds of houses sold last quarter were purchased in cash rather than via mortgage, per the Financial Times. In other words, the preponderance of homes were purchased by the very rich. Pamela Liebman, the chief executive of real estate brokerage firm Corcoran, told the paper, quote, "High mortgage rates are creating a real void for people who don't have the strong finances that are required to buy in cash. It's driving people who would be home buyers in New York into renting," end quote. This piece further notes that, quote, "Rents rose to an all-time median high of $3,950 per month." West Virginia News reports, quote, "Kroger union members have voted in favor of authorizing a strike at 38 stores in West Virginia, Kentucky, and Ohio," end quote. As this piece notes, the vote gives the bargaining committee authorization to call a strike at any time, but the workers are not currently on strike. In a statement, UFCW Local 400 said, quote, "This vote has sent a powerful message to Kroger that they must do better if they expect us to ratify a contract. Now, we are ready to sit down with the company and negotiate an agreement that we can recommend for ratification. If not, we are ready to continue to do whatever it takes to get a fair contract. By sticking together, we will win." Family Dollar has been hit with a $42 million fine in a food safety case after the company was found to have been, quote, "storing food, drugs, and cosmetics in a rodent-infested warehouse in Arkansas," end quote, according to More Perfect Union. An FDA investigation revealed, quote, "live rodents, dead and decaying rodents, rodent feces, urine, and odors, and evidence of gnawing and nesting throughout the facility," end quote. Family Dollar had been aware of the infestation since 2020 and continued shipping merchandise, often eaten into by the rodents, to 404 stores throughout the region. This is the largest ever criminal fine in a food safety case. Finally, on February 27th, MyHighPlains.com reported that a nuclear weapons factory in Texas was forced to cease operations in light of the state's massive wildfires. According to Hans Christensen, director of the Nuclear Information Project of the Federation of American Scientists, quote, "This is America's main nuclear weapons factory. Nearly 20,000 plutonium cores are stored there, and full-scale production of B-61-12 bomb and W-88-ALT-370 warheads are underway," end quote. While this critical situation was resolved without injury, it highlights the interrelation between climate change and national security. We urge military and civilian leadership to view this near miss as a chance to finally take the climate crisis seriously. This has been Francesco DeSantis with In Case You Haven't Heard.
And that's a wrap. Join us next week on the Ralph Nader Radio Hour. Until next time.
Stand up, stand up. You've been sitting with-